Welcome back to part three of our building a private cloud with Windows Server 2012 and System Center 2012 SP1 Jumpstart. I'm Simon Perryman. I'm joined once again by Pete Zerger. And with this module, we're really going to focus on preparing ourselves for self-service.
That's right. We are moving our way up the stack.
In our first couple of modules, we really kind of looked at our planning and design considerations. Our second module, we focused on actually deploying and configuring that infrastructure with our virtualized storage, virtualized networking, and then bringing our additional hosts under management. What's the next step?
Well, so now we're really looking less at the fabric and moving up into to building, constructing this service that we're then going to present to the end user. So I like to call this the fun part. So we're going to revisit that service template concept we talked about earlier. So we'll look at actually building service templates. I want to take you into some advanced capabilities there. We don't need to spend a lot of time there. I want to point out just some little bits and bobs here that you're going to find useful when you're trying to bridge those little gaps in specific scenarios. So I'll kind of call those out as we get there. We're going to look at runbook automation. So I hope many of you are already familiar with Orchestrator. If you're not, we will make sure you are when we're done.
We'll spend a few minutes just kind of going over the basics as well, getting you up and running.
Exactly right. So if you're already really familiar with Orchestrator, you'll have about 5 to 7 minutes to catch your breath, and then we'll be right back at it. And we'll talk about runbook automation, from a best practices perspective, how we build reliable workflows. At the end of the day, we need to build runbook automation that's reliable, but also self-sufficient in that it needs to clean up after itself. So we need to be monitoring for all manner of error conditions, which is the great thing about runbook automation is I can build very sophisticated sequences that are easy for my colleagues to support, but also give me great error checking and cleaning, so to speak. And we're going to talk about closing the loop with ITSM integration. So we need to be thinking about that ITIL process at the beginning, not the end. So when I design my process, I need to be thinking about how I'm going to close that loop. I'm going to document this activity in a service request, which is a special work item we have in Service Manager. I want to think about all of the affected parties or stakeholders in the process, who I'm going to be notifying at appropriate junctures, whether it's for approval or, hey, we're doing this, just want to make sure you're in the loop. We want to think through all of those little elements because at the end of the day, we're going to build an end-to-end, very polished process that may have some manual points where we need to gain approval and so forth, but we want to never leave people out of the loop where they need to be involved. So we're going to build something that answers more questions than it creates, I like to say. And we of course, need to provision cloud capacity. So we built the cloud fabric, and we need to now dole that out from a user perspective and grant permissions to some of these templates and so forth we're creating for deployment.
Excellent. Very quickly, some housekeeping. This session will last for approximately 90 minutes. Please feel free to ask Q&A to our live team of experts. And if you are watching this as a recording later, make sure you check out www.microsoftvirtualacademy for upcoming events where you will have another chance to go and interact with our awesome team here at Microsoft. Back to building and planning our service templates.
Yeah, so let's get started. Let's talk about some advanced template functionality. So we talked about those first-class application deployment capabilities, SQL data tier apps, or DAC packages as we call them, web deploy, server app V. We also had a look at generic command execution just as a gap filler that would allow us to run scripts before and after particular activities. I want to delve into that in slightly more detail. And we want to look at some of the other configurable service settings. There are some other capabilities that will allow us to do more automatically as part of this service template, need to rely on external processes less as we go along. So I want to look at what the full capability is with you there. Let's start by just talking about generic command execution at its most basic level. So I can execute custom scripts within service instances as I'm deploying. So I can specify a run as account. That run as capability comes with us with this generic command execution. So if I need to run some little piece of script with a particular set of credentials, I can do that. I can supply script parameters, and I don't. This really isn't limited to just PowerShell. I can even use batch files. So I can be very flexible in this, and we'll talk about how we leverage scripts in custom resources, we call them, in our library, and what we need to do to make VMM recognize our custom resources. With scripts, it's important to understand we have multiple entry points or multiple opportunities to run these scripts. So we can do this at an application level before we install, after we install, before and after we uninstall, and then we can actually, before we deploy the first component within the service as a whole and the last, you know, the last activity after we deploy the service as a whole. So we have multiple opportunities to do this, giving us a way to run those bits of automation in an orderly fashion so we know, you know, on the timeline of deployment where they happen. SQL profile. So I mentioned this briefly earlier. We have the capability to sysprep a SQL server, and quite simply it means we're going to install SQL 2008 R2 or SQL 2012 with the right sysprep option. And effectively what's going to happen there is a sysprep process to sysprep SQL before we sysprep the OS.
Now, that's great, because one of the questions I've just seen come up is, what are the different sysprep opportunities? Can I sysprep these independently? Sounds like we can. Are there any other ways where, as part of this deployment, people can inject custom scripts, you know, run once scripts, other types of things?
So generic command execution allows that. So, and I suspect some of these questions may come from folks that are more familiar with the VMware way of templating, right? So a VMware template is fundamentally very different from a Hyper-V template, and it comes down to when we sysprep. So on the VMware side of the house, we sysprep at deploy time, which means we have a template that's really just a VM with a little checkbox mark that says this is a template. On the Hyper-V side, we sysprep at design time. So I install SQL. If I'm going to sysprep SQL, I handle that process. Then I sysprep the virtual machine, and then it goes in my library. So it's now kind of sealed up. But as I deploy, if we go back to virtual machine templates, we do have, you know, the GUI run once option. We have an answer file capability, so we can inject lots of input into that process. We can also run those generic command executions to fill some gaps as well. I have a little batch file I love to run to add a group to local administrators on virtual machines that we self-service provision. Because a very common scenario is we deploy virtual machines for a group of developers that will share those, and although one person deployed and is the owner, we want to make sure the entire team has access. And so generic command execution makes that a really easy task for us. Yeah. So many opportunities to do that. And if I didn't fully answer that question, feel free to rephrase, and I'll be happy to come back to that, and we'll drill down on that. And again, with this sysprepped SQL instance, what this allows us to do is at deploy, you know, within the service template, configure the parameters for deployment, the instance name, the security mode, meaning are we going to run Windows or SQL or mixed, turning on protocols, TCP/IP name pipes, providing our SA account password, service account identity. So what is the SQL Server service going to run in the context of? So I can do all of that within my SQL profiles to make this largely a hands-free process. And then, you know, tack onto that our capability to deploy SQL DAC packages, you know, entire databases, and run SQL scripts before and after to do additional work in that database after we get it deployed. And I've given a lot of lip service to web deploy packages. You've seen them in action. You may be asking yourself, how do I build a web deploy package, which is a great question. And I want to just show you quickly that this is really not a terribly challenging task. So I'm going to show you web deploy package, the build process. So I'll jump over to another machine. What I also want to do is show you the SQL data tier application build process, also very IT pro friendly. So I don't want you to think that you need to be a .NET developer, that I have to load Visual Studio, that I'm going to roll up my sleeves and this is going to take all day. So I'm looking at Internet Information Server. I've got IIS Manager up here. I have a default website here. So full disclosure, I have loaded a component called WebDeploy 3.0. You download that from the Microsoft website. If you just go Bing it, just download WebDeploy 3.0 download. It's a very small installer, couple of megs. And now that I've installed that, I'm going to right-click my default website here. And when I go down here to the deploy menu for that site, you'll notice there is an export application option. So this gives me the this is my process to build that web deploy package. So I was dealing with a very simple application. That file, that Contoso web app we were looking at, was really just this file right here. So you'll notice that I've unchecked everything except the file I want to package in this case. I'll hit next. And to be clear, if I wanted to package something in a special folder and so forth, I could, through this wizard, provide a custom provider and path to an executable and a script and so forth. All very UI friendly. It would be very unusual that I would need to do that, in my experience anyway. So I have basically my provider, my IIS app, and it's basically matching to default website. This does make an assumption when I try to deploy this to another environment, you know, in the context of a service template, that the same configuration is true. So if I have legacy components enabled, if my configuration is fundamentally different in a way that's going to break this, the deployment will fail. So we want to make sure that where we're building these packages, the IIS instance matches that of where we intend to deploy. So really one-to-one to ensure success and predictable behavior of our application. So you see here, getting a prompt to just pick a folder. So I'll pick the web deploy folder and I'll call this web deploy 1.3. And I want you to notice here that all it's doing is creating a zip file. It's not creating any sort of fancy format. So I'll hit next, finish. It's going to create my web deploy package. And then the next question is, okay, what do I do with this now? Well, what I do with this now is take it and put it into my library, into my VMM library. So I'll just quickly go to scvmm1 here. I'm going to look at my library from the, why don't I look at my library from the inside? Let's make this easier. The wonders of Active Directory authentication. So I'm just going to leverage my investment in Active Directory by using the login that I already have in place. There's my library. So if I drill down in here, I actually put this package out there earlier in its 1.2 form. So you put this out into your library. Your library is going to refresh on an hourly basis automatically. You can go hit the refresh button automatically by simply going to the library workspace in your VMM console, right-clicking and selecting refresh on that library. So not a big deal. That's a web deploy package. Let's talk for un momento about SQL data tier applications. So I have in front of me here SQL Management Studio. So an application all of your developers, your SQL DBAs are very comfortable with, right? So here's Corp Tracking, my custom database that tracks the corp. So I'm going to right click this, much as I right clicked on my default website. And I'm going to have some capability here too in some menus. If I go to tasks in this case, you will see extract data tier application. I can launch yet another wizard that will take me step by step through a UI and build. You notice here it's very, very clear. This extracts a data tier application from an instance of SQL Server to a DAC package. This is going to build the package. So folks, there's the bottom line. UI operation, run the wizard. Put it out in your library, refresh manually, or wait for the default, and you're in a good place. And you could actually point this wizard straight out to the library if that's what you wanted to do. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time because there's not a lot to it, folks. It's really that simple. And when you think about your DBAs that are maybe not able to provision quite fast enough, this is a common thing I see in the field all the time. We have database admins that just can't provision new SQL instances as fast as they are asked for them. So with that SQL sysprep capability in SQL 2008 R2 or in SQL Server 2012, we can make this a largely hands-free process to shorten the time from request to provisioning. So getting IT out of the way. Why is that important? What's going to happen if I don't get out of the way, if I don't accelerate this process? The sad fact of the matter is, if IT doesn't get out of the way, people will find a way to get work done. They will go around processes. Mm-hmm. I had an organization that woke up one day and found that their developers had a test environment in the cloud. They had something in a public cloud environment because they couldn't get VMs provisioned in less than 4 to 6 weeks, and they had to get their work done. and they'd even use some of their own money. It's a really weird situation, but just, you know, absolute proof that people will do what they need to do. And if we're in the way, if we can't, you know, streamline this process, that's really what private cloud is all about. I can automate these processes to the degree I can, to where the process from a manual perspective, you know, becomes one of approval. So I can, if I can respond to an email and type approved, you know, I can have visibility into what's being provisioned, at the same time not holding up the provisioning process. So that being said, I want to talk to you about application hosts. So in production environments, it's totally common that we need to deploy new databases and apps to existing large shared SQL clusters, maybe physical clusters if we're not on board the SQL virtualization train yet, which is different from the soul train, just to be clear. but for this reason, in VMM, and this was actually available in RTM, we have the capability to create, configure a SQL Server application host. It's a profile that defines a potentially a physical SQL Server outside our service template where we need to deploy an application. So Service Pack 1 actually extends this one degree in that we can also create an application host, a profile for web servers. If we'd like to deploy a web deploy package to some farm or other entity outside our service template, we have that capability as well. And that's down there in the templates area we looked at in the VMM console. So again, wizard-driven, dead simple, and we can supply that as we're configuring the application component within our service template to simply point to an external source instead of the web tier or the SQL tier, you know, within our service template. So this is an area that most people I find don't know about. You know, I do have customers at this point that are already using System Center 2012. They've delved into VMM and service templates. They're not new, but there are some configurable service settings out there that I find folks are surprised by.
So why would you want to use variables in the first place?
So if I need to supply, and you know, that's actually something you might think about and say, you know, I really can't imagine why you would want to do that in the first place. Well, there may be a value that I don't know the value of at design time, so I can only supply it at deploy time. Perhaps a password. Maybe I'm using SQL security and I don't know the password, or I don't know what my instance name is going to be. They're actually, and with that variable concept, there's some predefined values. Computer name and VM ID we get for free. You just have to put these ampersand symbols on each side of your string, and as you deploy the template, you'll be prompted for those values at deploy time. I find this is great, you know, with App Controller, with my IT folk, my IT, you know, my developers or my infrastructure folks that need to deploy something, but we need to give them some flexibility to supply some values at deploy time.
And just to clarify, we can do that using either Virtual Machine Manager or using App Controller.
Right, yeah. So
As I'm going through the deployment template, the deployment process.
Right, yeah, you're going to have some values kind of thrown at you there, right. So, for sure. And we don't see them used every day, but when you need them, you know you need them. You wake up and discover, you know, there's a value I can't provide here because I don't know what it is, and that variable capability, so to speak, is going to be the way we deal with that. Now, you can't really see a lot of detail here by design, but when we hit the deploy option, so we highlight our service template, we hit the deploy option, there's three basic steps in this process. So we're going to deploy a template to the cloud. There's going to be that intelligent placement process that will determine where we're going to put this service template. We can access the template and change any configurable values. So we might be prompted to supply machine names. For example, you know, App Controller is going to prompt you if there's a machine name. If you're missing something, you're going to see a little asterisk in red that's going to tell you need to go supply a value here before I can deploy. Any configurable setting. So in the upper left of this picture, you can't see a lot of detail, but those are those variables, so to speak. Those values we've concatenated with the ampersand on each side. They're going to show up right there in the template in the deployment preview automatically.
Now, I think, you know, big advantage as far as doing this during the deployment time is that you get it up and running with the correct names, the correct variable names, correct server names, as soon as it goes into production. There's not this additional step, this additional overhead of having to log into the server, join a domain, change server names, etc.
Exactly. And so Simon hits the nail on the head here. We don't have to go back and rename SQL instances or passwords. You know, we can supply all that, but if you can't supply that for whatever reason, we can build that flexibility into our templates if that's what we feel we need to do. So let's talk about, we haven't talked about the VMM library yet, so I want to talk about what lives in this VMM library, why that's important. We have the templates, virtual machine templates, service templates that we've been talking about and digging into in waves here. We have the profiles, the application host profile, the SQL profiles that we'll configure to enable those application deployment capabilities. We can also supply self-service user content, so we can supply additional VMM libraries for our cloud tenants. And in fact, if we're going to allow our tenants to, for example, store their virtual machines in a library, we have to supply a place for that to go. It can't go into our primary VMM library here. Now, you also see file-based resources here, so I'm going to talk about custom resources in kind of a one-off way. So a custom resource is any file-based resource that I need to get in there, typically a script that I need to get into VMM to use as part of my deployment process. So to make VMM recognize something as a custom resource, I simply create a folder and give it a name that ends in .cr for custom resource, and then it's going to automatically be identified. And if you were to go look in the library, under the hood, you'll see a little signature that's written down there behind the scenes. Not really important, but VMM recognizes that component that we've called the custom resources. As I mentioned, I tend to use that a lot for scripts to do little bits and bobs, like adding a group as local administrator, for example. So let's just jump out and look at multi-tier templates in my environment here, and I'm going to prove that I am a little smarter this time, and I'll get out of presentation mode so we can give this a proper go. And I'm going to have a look over at the environment where we were this morning, where we had a pretty sizable two-tier template. And I can pull up my library here. Let's just take a peek through our library to see what we have in terms of resources in our library. We have all of these new profile and template capabilities, so lots more than we would have seen in a Virtual Machine Manager 2008 library for sure. So I want to show you just a custom resource here. You see .NET 2.0? Yep. We needed to deploy a legacy version of .NET 2.0, so there it is in the form of a folder with that .cr extension. That's all I need to do to tell VMM to recognize that resource. And I'm going to drill down into that folder and have a look with me here at what we see. You'll notice that there's my .NET 2.0 framework. You see this little scvmmcr tag. It's recognized this and tagged it. So that's my hint that I've done this right. And this is actually a great little troubleshooting mechanism, because if I'm missing something in my library, I can actually come look and see why I don't see it. And if I see the tag there, I know it's been recognized. If it's not, I need to figure out why not. Most common reason is going to be refresh your library. It only refreshes once an hour. So when in doubt, if there's something not showing up in the UI in your service, in your designer interface, go refresh your library, and then we'll start troubleshooting from that point. So that being said, let's just look at the wizard and what we'll look at building a template from scratch. And I'm not going to go all the way through it, but I want to show you the options you're given when you launch this interface. So you'll notice that I'm right-clicking a lot. I'm a right-click fan. The ribbon gives you an equivalent capability to launch these menus, so one is not more right than the other. It's just your navigational preference. So have a look at this with me. You'll notice that from a service template perspective, I could use a blank template and I could add as many tiers as I want. In fact, Microsoft, back in beta whatever of System Center 2012, provided us a four-tier service template. It actually had a web tier and a couple of application tiers and a SQL tier on the back end. So there's not a 1-to-3-tier limit, but I wanted to point out, as you see here, you see blank, one tier, two tier, three tier. So common application deployment models, right? So I'll look at a two-tier and we'll just watch what happens as we drop this in. So automatically, I now have my two-tier application, you'll see that the network is there. It says not connected, because that's all going to be picked up from the virtual machine templates that we drop into this environment. So I will find the templates that I want here.
Now, as I take a look at this image on the screen here, I see that we have NIC1, NIC1 listed. Now, I'm assuming those are virtual NICs, vNICs that come as part of this template. We can then take those network connections and hook it up to something.
Yeah, more or less. So think of these as empty containers, which we have not populated yet with a virtual machine template. So VMM is going to take its cue for how that network needs to be configured by what we drop in. Now, if we have added additional providers to VMM, let's say you've added a load balancer, for example. So Microsoft gives us network load balancing by default. I could add an extra tier down here below these NICs in the form of a load balancer. So let me just show you here. Up here on the ribbon, add load balancer. And there we
go. Pretty straightforward to configure. A lot easier than having to go deploy NLB yourself, right?
Right. You know, I think the main challenge I had early on with service templates was RTFM, right? So read the friendly manual. and you know, granted, there are always going to be those edge cases where maybe you need to come get a little help. And Microsoft, you know, TechNet has great forums where you can ask, you know, the experts and get a little leg up on those special scenarios if you just can't find it through a search engine. But a lot of ground has been covered here in those terms. I'm going to remove the load balancer simply because I don't have one. Just kind of note to self on this. If you deploy a load balancer and that load balancer needs IP addresses, we'll find down there in the same area where we configure IP pools, we can configure a VIP template, a virtual IP template that tells us how we're going to address and what the load balancing mechanism is for the load balancer that we've done the drag and drop with into our interface. So if it's a Microsoft load balancer, NLB, that's going to be one thing, but we could also, from Citrix or F5, get a physical load balancer that we specify, or more likely a virtual load balancer, a virtual machine that is an F5 or a Citrix NetScaler appliance.
And essentially has that logic that was built in the hardware, now directly built into the software.
Except it's extra cool because I'm not dealing with another physical appliance.
Not actually wiring those NICs, yeah, the different networking components together.
Yeah, you know, and I've never been a fan of setting up the hardware. I want to make it sing and dance, you know, in at the application tier. This is the job upgrade you're getting, folks. So don't be worried, you know, that you're automating yourself out of a job. You're automating yourself into a more exciting, more important job. You know, at the end of the day, when I, you know, entered IT, I wanted to do something that to the business as a whole, as to those C people, you know, C-level people, made a difference. So a CIO would come to me and say, you know what, this really mattered. This enabled our company to do something we couldn't otherwise do. And that's what this is going to do for your organization. You know, nobody's ever going to appreciate us performing lots of manual tasks, writing, you know, low-level scripts. It's really automation from a process perspective that's interfacing with the business, allowing us to drive their work more efficiently and freeing up time for us to innovate.
To do more with less, right? You're only one person, you have 40 hours a week, but if you can free up 20 hours of those time, I'm sure everybody out there has a long checklist of just tasks that they haven't got to. That's one of these big goals with automation. Get rid of those repetitive tasks, free up your time, work on new projects that add new value to the business, and ultimately, you know, you're becoming more valuable to the company because, again, it's not those repetitive tasks. It's creative functionality that you're now adding to improve processes, add new services, make your company more competitive.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm just going to drag one of my SQL templates out here. Now, you notice these tiers don't have names, you know, nice names by default. So what I like to do is give my tiers very predictable names. And the reason I like to do this is as we work our way into Service Manager, into that polished self-service user experience, if I standardize the names, it's going to potentially make things like scale-out operations down the road easier for me because I don't have to go do a lot of, you know, machine tier lookup. So I tend to name them, you know, SQL tier, app tier, web tier. You may decide you want to do it the slightly more labor-intensive way and that you may have to go look that up. I found that this works really well for me and my customers, though I keep it as simple as possible. So I've given it my web tier. What you'll notice about the deployment order and the servicing order is everybody thinks they're first by default. So notice as I flip between these two, application deployment order and servicing order doesn't change. So we need to set the pace here. So typically I think SQL would roll out first and the web would roll out number two. My web's also going to be typically a scale out tier. So I'll configure my min and max instances. So Simon, why don't you talk about an availability set? You notice I have an availability set box here. So tell the folks.
So availability sets is kind of an interesting concept to really help you ensure that your virtual machines are distributed across different hosts. Now, one challenge that we saw with a lot of customers, you know, they might have virtualized both of their domain controllers. Well, if two of those domain controllers are now, you know, running on a single host, you lose that host, you've essentially lost your whole infrastructure. So the idea of availability groups is to basically say this VM and this VM are part of the same group, hence we want to try to separate them as much as possible by moving them around a cluster using a live migration. You know, we often see this used as well with a guest cluster. Remember, a guest cluster is a fully virtualized cluster. If we have a physical host and it's running all four of our SQL guest cluster nodes, that's still a single point of failure. I lose that host, I lose my entire guest cluster. So availability groups are a great way to really optimize the distribution and the placement of your virtual machines across different hosts.
And I can configure that in my service template so it's automatic.
So as soon as you go and deploy a new instance of your guest cluster, of your domain control, it's automatically distributed and spread out across your different infrastructure.
I'm ready for prime time out of the box. So whilst Simon was chatting there, I took this web template and I dropped it into my web tier, and you'll notice that my networking is configured automatically because the virtual machine templates were configured with their network connectivity. So they're both connected to their production VM network in this case. So all of the work that we did in the fabric to configure a logical and virtual networking, we're just leveraging that preparation now. So and as we move up the stack, when we get into App Controller and Service Manager and the self-service interfaces, we're just leveraging our previous efforts as we're building our way up the stack, so to speak. So let's look at adding applications now. So leveraging SQL DAC and Web Deploy. So I'm not going to go all the way, but I just want to take you far enough that you see how we add these in a way that makes sense and give you a couple of reminders from this morning about some advanced functionality that you may see in a VM template but only comes when we leverage a service template. So I am in the application configuration node. I'm actually going to go up one step, and I just wanted to remind you, roles, features. We can turn
this
them
is where I can basically pre-install, pre-enable these different components.
Right. This is fantastic. This was like Christmas come early the first time I saw this. This is very impressive stuff. So for my web tier, I might be turning on .NET Framework, turning on the IIS.
And you get to reduce a reboot as well, right? Because oftentimes, hey, you go log in, you install, got to do that reboot again. So really try to simplify that, have everything kind of pre-installed, basically.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm going to go back to my application configurator here, and for SQL, you'll notice here I have a SQL profile already set up. I sorted this out with my DBAs, and this was that massive standard database that they were going to deploy for StockTrader. So you can actually download this somewhere on the Microsoft site if you go out and do a little searching for this. But you'll notice here I've got the name, a deployment name, but I want to show you here we've got a SQL instance name. We've got the type of authentication we're going to set, so Windows or SQL. We can set the mode for what happens when we uninstall. So do we just detach the database or do we drop it? The answer to that is going to be very organizationally specific, and your DBAs are really going to be able to tell you there. And I have some advanced capability to come in here and configure some uninstall, some uninstall and upgrade behavior. And then we have the SQL Server scripts. So I have some post-install capability, and these, again, I'm going to have an opportunity before and after each deployment to run more scripts. So your DBAs can supply exactly what we need in that DAC package to make all of this happen. So a lot of capability here from a SQL perspective. But it does require we sort of take that step, you know, not even to the latest version of SQL, just SQL 2008 R2. And I would imagine most of your organizations are using 2008 R2 at this point.
So. Certainly want to encourage that.
Yes, yes. And in fact, I very unashamedly don't really worry about organizations saying, well, we really need SQL, 2005 or 2000 support. No, we need to figure out how we can forklift your processes, up to the modern versions of the software. Again, the web deploy package, really similar in that respect. And I want to go back over in a minute to our completed template so I can show you some of these advanced configurations that we have there. So when we're looking at our web template, biggest change, frankly, is that we would be deploying our web apps, so our web deploy package. And again, I can come in and change this at deploy time. You'll notice that I have property already set there in the default website. I could change that if I needed to. So that was picked up when we created that web deploy package because I was actually extracting the configuration from the default website on the host. Web servers, remember, are probably going to need, they're definitely going to need, IIS. But if you go to roles here, this was a web server, right? So we had already done some configuration here. So you notice my template here says NLB web template. Mm-hmm. So if I deployed this as a standalone VM, none of that has any effect. You see here as in the service template, this is going to light that up. I have also some .NET framework happening here for my .NET applications. No real surprise there. So that's all going to roll out as part of the OS deployment. Then my application is deployed, and we're ready to go. So at this point, I'm adding applications. I'm configuring my deployment and my servicing order. My networking largely taken care of for me unless I get into load balancers and advanced configurations, in which case I may have a little bit of additional work to do. So let's get into one of those templates we were looking at this morning. And I'm just going to open this up in the designer. And again, we have our SQL tier, we have our web tier. I'll zoom this for those of you without X-ray or superhuman vision. So you may be the man of steel, but unless you can see like him, here we go. And I'll just drill down into here. And so this, just so you know, this is the same configuration we had before. So nothing fancy here. This is actually just what I did the drag and drop on in just a few seconds, frankly. I went from zero to this in a few seconds because I created the template one time with my DBA. So you're going to create those SQL profiles probably multiple times, to lay out the different types of databases and database instances they might need to deploy. but point being, we're templating that, so to speak, so we don't need to bring our DBA back every time we need to deploy a service, which is a very good thing. To be sure, we're optimizing the expensive, the time of the expensive resources. So I'll put a service name in here. So when I hit the button and get into my preview mode for deployment, this is where intelligent placement is going to kick in. You're going to notice I get a little prompt here to hit the refresh button to see placement results. So I refresh the preview. It does its work, and if I have if I'm attempting to deploy a template that's properly wired to my fabric, if the cloud I'm trying to deploy into has access to the underlying logical and physical resources, it will attempt to place these on hosts. If I, on the other hand, try to deploy to a cloud for which we don't have any connection to the logical and physical resources that have been provisioned to that tenant, you get what you see here. And I wanted to show you how the error messages are laid out. So you notice at the bottom here, we get some prompt to tell us that we've tried to do something that's, frankly, just not possible. And actually what I've done here is tried to deploy a Hyper-V-based template to a VMware-based cloud. So VMM knows I can't cross those boundaries, but more importantly, I haven't granted permissions to the tenants of that Hyper-V cloud to VMware resources. That wouldn't make sense. So once we hit that deployment button, I'm going to hit delete here, which is actually going to delete a kind of an underlying deployment configuration file that gets created as we run that wizard. It's actually possible for you to run that wizard to partial completion and then save it off and come back and finish later, and your in-progress configuration will still be there.
Nice.
Not a common operation for me, but nice to know it's there, so if I need to go fix something and then potentially come back and deal with it a little bit later. So now I'm just back looking at my running instance. So I've got my two-tier service with my web tier, and I scaled out earlier. You may recall we looked at how easy it was to scale out. Well, now I have two web servers in that tier. So thinking about the paradigm of cloud, we can scale out. We also want to think about scaling in. So when we don't need those VMs anymore, you want to also have a mechanism to destroy those, right? To scale in, so to speak.
Now that's an important point of this cloud architecture, cloud automation. A lot of people forget, right? We had this problem with the server sprawl in the past. Kind of seeing a similar problem now with the VM sprawl. So certainly kind of this ongoing monitoring, really got to keep that in mind as a best practice.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really what, as we move into day two and we start talking about monitoring and chargeback and some of the governance aspects of this, it's basically moderating behavior. This really empowers us when I can click a button and have, multiple servers and databases and web applications deployed. It makes it trivial, and I might just decide, I'm going to deploy as is convenient for me. But, that's what, the other sort of paradigm of cloud, one of those key elements according to NIST is that it's metered by use. So people behave much differently when it's free. And we'll look at chargeback on Thursday. And I want you to come back and look at chargeback with me because we're going to talk about monitoring of your private cloud in a very real way. I want to have a chat with you about the IP pools because there's a gap there. And as I mentioned, we can solve virtually any problem in more than one way with System Center. I'm going to show you what we can do with System Center to bridge some of those little gaps to make sure we're monitoring our capacity and our performance and our consumption. So that is the next phase of service templates there. So lots of advanced capabilities to allow us to deploy more than just virtual machines, to connect them to more than just a single network. If I had multiple network adapters there, if I wanted to do that PVLAN network virtualization scenario I described earlier, I could conceivably build that into a template if I were so inclined. So,
great. So let's kind of quickly review this part of the self-service process. So part of self-service, step one, we talked about building our service templates. Now, the reason why we want to build those essentially is to give our end users the option to pick something that's perfectly designed, perfectly configured. They don't need to pick up the phone and wait 3 days or 6 weeks for this IT department to go and build it. So now that we've got this template and we know what's going to be deployed, what's going to be used, what's the next step we need to think about?
So that sets the stage perfectly for the next topic, and that's runbook automation. So once we've created that template, which we can deploy directly from App Controller, if we desire that sort of lightweight experience that's outside of our approval workflow process, we're in a good place already. I can go deploy a service template in App Controller right now. It's done. In fact, we'll just pop over there. And the point being that if I don't need approval workflow, I have what I need here right now. So in fact, I'd already deployed a service earlier today, just right here from the UI. I can right-click and deploy, and if I'm in a user role that has access to the appropriate resources, to the fabric, etc., and you notice here, I don't have permission to deploy to the cloud. So people can see some things they can't necessarily deploy. Point being, I have some resources deployed here already, and if I have that developer-type audience that needs to be able to roll out, roll back, snapshot, potentially, if I give them access to do that, they have full autonomy to do that in App Controller. So I'm just going to go into the properties of this virtual machine and just kind of point out here again. I can click through my VM properties, and here's checkpoints. Now, you'll notice here that all of these are grayed out. I'm not a fan of giving people permission to checkpoint. That's going to be a use case specific entitlement. So my developers that are checkpointing, installing, you know, their application, testing, and then potentially rolling back, that's a business need for checkpointing. Am I still going to watch them to make sure that I don't have checkpoints on live machines that are persisting for days or weeks or months? Oh, yes, I am. But there's going to be a use case for that, and App Controller makes it very easy for me to surface that capability to the more autonomous user, you know, on the development and test side.
Now, one thing that I want to point out both about App Controller as well as our service catalogs and Service Manager is you access everything through a web page. Now, this is important when we try to think about these end users requested self-service, right? This isn't us. This isn't the guy who goes into Virtual Machine Manager and has all of these options. This is somebody that just may not be comfortable with these advanced managements. This might be the HR department. This might be, you know, your mom or your dad if they're your customer. And so what we really wanted to do is have this single pane of glass, make everything web-based just to simplify the deployment. So just go to a website, enter the address, and then we'll give you those options of taking you to Service Manager, App Controller, wherever you need to be redirected to.
Yeah, that's a great point. Again, we have to begin with the end user in mind. Who's going to be in the chair trying to use, you know, this service that we're delivering? So App Controller has an audience, and it tends to be a more technologically savvy audience, more of an IT pro developer type audience.
They have some understanding of a service, right?
Whereas
right. When we do like a service catalog, we're even abstracting that to use just normal language, right? Normal people language, as opposed to slightly more technical with App Controller, and then we go down to nerd talk when we log into VMF.
I love that normal people language. So yeah, that's a great point. And when we don't need that snapshotting capability, that flexibility, when we need greater abstraction, when we need approval, that's where the service manager, you know, self-service component and our underlying workflow and notification capabilities are going to make sense. So let's talk about the next component in the soup here, runbook automation, which in System Center 2012 comes in the form of Orchestrator. So at a very basic level, if you're not an Orchestrator person today, if you're not familiar, I like to think of Orchestrator as automating, as process automation in a Visio-like interface. I have a console that gives me a canvas where I can drag and drop little icons we call activities. And we have activities, we call them standard activities. There are a few dozen of these, and they are product agnostic. Standard activities will allow us to monitor files and folders, to log events and notify people, to connect into external systems like web services, to SQL databases, query SQL databases, like my favorite activity in the world. We have capability to connect across platform systems, Linux and Unix, run SSH command. You know, the question to ask yourself with Orchestrator is never, can I do this with Orchestrator? Because I'm an absolute believer that virtually anything is possible with Orchestrator if I have an interface for it. It's, should I be doing this with Orchestrator? And what do I mean by that? I mean, Orchestrator gives me the capability to go out and probe a website. There are activities for secure FTP I can use to, you know, go out and connect to a secure FTP site, FTPS or SFTP, log in, check and see if it's available, upload a file, download a file, create a directory. Those are all sort of monitoring elements, but I try to be careful about how I'm using this because Operations Manager is my monitoring component. Which is the good news there is Orchestrator natively integrates with all of the other components in the System Center family: Ops Manager, Configuration Manager, Virtual Machine Manager, Service Manager. So if I'm inclined to integrate with my ITIL processes in Service Manager, I have native activities I can drag onto this palette to do that. If I'm quasi-monitoring some complex service from Orchestrator, like that FTP scenario, which I do all the time actually, there is an activity called Create Alert. So I can actually monitor and just create an alert directly in Operations Manager from Orchestrator if that's what I want to do. And it makes total sense, and it saves me from having to write a management pack. It's kind of a point solution within the System Center family. And my integration is there. I can still, you know, have visibility into incidents and my alerts, but driving activity out of Orchestrator, whether it's deployment or remediation or, you know, something else.
Now, we have an interesting question here come up, kind of integrating our VMM service templates with Orchestrator. So the specific question is, can I start an Orchestrator runbook from a template? And then let's answer that the other way around. Can I do a template from Orchestrator?
So could I start
an Orchestrator runbook via a template? Now, would that be possible maybe using one of our executables that we can go run once we first start the VM?
So one of my later demonstrations is going to be how you would initiate an Orchestrator runbook from PowerShell. So can I run a PowerShell script from a service template, Simon? And if I can, the answer is yes.
Great.
So we'll actually look at what you need to do in order to initiate a runbook from outside Orchestrator just a little bit later in this session, I believe.
And then to answer kind of the inverse of that, yes, you certainly can use virtual machine templates using Orchestrator. Orchestrator is very extensible. So
yeah,
you can go deploy a new VM based on a template, that type of thing.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear more of the details of that process just to understand what it is exactly you'd want to do. But yeah, lots of options there. Even if I wanted to, upon completion of that service deployment, trigger, configuration manager, agent deployment very quickly, et cetera. There are lots of ways I could achieve that. It's really just understanding the most efficient way. Because I can build runbooks to do everything. I find sometimes that we begin to overutilize runbooks, like configuration manager. Could I use Orchestrator to deploy a config manager agent in a timely way? I could, but I could also use a startup script. In group policy, I could use tried and true mechanisms that are already there, so I don't overutilize Orchestrator. Because I can also sort of overutilize Orchestrator and neglect the other technologies that are here to serve those purposes. So really, think about it from a best practice / intended purpose perspective in mind. So I want to just proactively address the question I know is coming, and I'm surprised Simon hasn't asked it yet, is can I connect to X? So it's not...
I'm starting to get those questions in. Can I integrate with this, with this, with this?
Here's the avalanche is coming, and so we're running ahead. So the answer is, generally speaking, yes.
Yes.
So Orchestrator is really attempting to reproduce human, manual processes in an automated form. So we need to have an interface into those systems. Now, Microsoft gives us some integration packs, some sets of activities I can drag into this palette you'll see in a moment that will allow us to leverage that. So there's an FTP pack, Exchange, Active Directory, all of the System Center components, both our legacy System Center families, the 2007 to 2010, as I like to call them, as well as 2012 RTM and SP1. You'll also notice some third-party management platforms mentioned here. You see Blade Logic, you see HP, you see IBM, you see VMware vSphere. So as I alluded to before our meal break, maybe vCenter integration is not possible in your environment today, and that's okay. We have an Orchestrator, a VMware vSphere pack. I actually have a client where we're using this in their cloud environment to deploy their Linux and Unix systems, and there are a lot of politics that went into why we had to do that, but Orchestrator to the rescue, and as you'll see as we move into the realm of the top of the mountain of self-service, our ITIL integrated self-service strategy, I can connect these runbooks into that self-service interface and service manager to collect the user input and drive this automation behind the scenes. So I like to think that service manager is putting that policy, that ITIL process wrapper and validation around everything we're collecting from the user, so Orchestrator can focus on what we've created this runbook to do, which is to provision something, to complete some process in our environment. I just want to point out, free integration packs are also available out there on the net, out at codeplex.com. In fact, scorch.codeplex.com and orchestrator.codeplex.com, you'll find community integration packs that support even augment these legacy versions of Active Directory and Exchange. There's some data manipulation, scheduled tasks, a group maintenance mode for Ops Manager. I bring this up to say Microsoft encourages you to use these integration packs. Now, granted, if you call in for support and you run into a problem that's clearly one of these, if centered around one of these unsupported integration packs, I don't believe Microsoft support is probably going to troubleshoot that for you and fix it for you, but they're certainly not going to hang up on you because you're leveraging great community resources. So don't be shy with adequate testing, right? So when we get a solution from Microsoft, we know that's gone through all of those processes that Simon talked about.
They were so CEC, common engineering criteria.
Yeah, frankly, they were so extensive. I fell asleep somewhere in the middle, so I'm not sure what they all were, but they were there, right? So we know, buyer beware. When we're getting something for free, you get what you pay for. So, not to say that they're not great, but need your testing. So, what I thought we might do is just have a quick tour around the Orchestrator console. So let's have a quick look at the UI, what it is we can do in Orchestrator, and I just want to connect the dots for those of you that maybe don't have a lot of Orchestrator experience today. Maybe you've not worked with Orchestrator before. So we're going to start right here in my Orchestrator environment. This is what we call the Runbook Designer. So
now this is like the Visio drag and drop interface you were mentioning before, right?
Exactly. This is the Visio interface in my mind that's now right here. And you'll have a lot of icons. So you see over to the right here, this is our activities palette, we call this. And you'll see a lot of what we call the standard activities. They're product agnostic. So if I just go right to the top, up to system, you see all sorts of powerful capabilities, end process, grabbing SNMP variables, WMI queries, restarting a computer, running a .NET script. So I can actually, if I know PowerShell, if I know .NET languages, if I know VBScript, I can use run.NET script to run snippets of my code and publish information out to my shared data bus. And you'll see I can even run programs. There's SSH commands, so lots of capabilities here. So one of the places I see folks leveraging a lot, and I think sometimes this comes just because it's easy to do, is the file and folder. So under file management, we have this monitor folder capability. So if I wanted to watch for a new file coming into a folder, I can drag monitor folder out here. This is going to create what we call a monitor style runbook. I don't use these with Service Manager, but I can create runbooks that will actually run all the time. So a monitoring style runbook is going to go monitor a folder for some activity to happen. So I'll just drill down and find a folder. Why don't we just call it the Azure folder for the sake of argument. You'll notice I have filters down here. So I'll hit the Add button and I can tell Orchestrator what filters I want to watch for potentially. So I'm going to be very generic. I'm going to say file name matches a star dot text pattern. And then I'm going to look at the trigger. So I can tell Orchestrator what about that text file is going to trigger you to do something. Well, if the number of files is greater than 4, I want you to do something with these files, so I can build that capability. Then what do I want to do? Well, when I get over the threshold, maybe I then want to move those files somewhere. So now I have two activities on the palette here. When I mouse over an activity, you notice that I get those little triangles. We call those link handles. And a monitoring activity only has one because it's always going to be at the beginning of the runbook. But I'm going to just left mouse click hold and I'll drag and drop. So by default, a runbook's going to do something very simple here. When our monitor folder criteria finds more than 4 of these files, it's going to automatically trigger according to the link logic. When monitor folder is triggered successfully, trigger the move file. So A is initiated, is triggered, so B is going to execute automatically. Going to double click into that next activity, and I'm just going to, when I want to move this file, maybe I want to move it over to an archive directory, I can manually specify a bunch of files in multiple move file activities, or I can dynamically subscribe to that information from the previous activity. So the wonderful thing about Orchestrator is this runbook is going to all run in the process of in the context of a Windows process, policymodule.exe it's called. And each of these activities automatically publishes data that I can subscribe to. I don't have to work to get this, it's just there. So when I right-click in this file spot here, I can go to Published Data, and I can look to see if this gives me what I want. So maybe what I'm looking for here is the name of the file. So what you see here is this actually won't do what I want, which brings me to the reality of runbook automation is you're going to sort of build these to a drag drop and done form. They're not polished, they're not fully ready for production, because I don't have any air checking in here, and we need to build that into the process. What I want to do is quickly flip over to some other activities and show you some other run books that might be a little closer to that best practice. So as I build run books, they all start like this. They're just simple. They don't have any... I can look at this and more or less tell what it's doing. It says it's reading a line from something, and it's logging a platform event, which is actually just an event down here on this little events tab at the bottom. But raises the question, what is a run book that's been built to best practices? So we'll talk about that in a second. I want to cover off interfaces, orchestration console. I'm going to launch the orchestration web console, which is right here. Orchestration web console gives us the ability to grant users permission to initiate runbooks. They can go look at the stats on runbooks to see which runbooks have executed, how many times have they run, how many successes, how many failures. There's no authoring experience here, though. The other really, really important mechanism, so there's a URL here that's well known in the world, but this is my Orchestrator web service. This is a RESTful, it's a OData web service. It's
standard API.
Standard REST API, but I can use this web service to initiate runbooks from outside Orchestrator. So when you say, can I initiate a runbook from a service template, from X, from Y, from Z, there's a PowerShell script published by Microsoft on MSDN. I'm going to show you what you need to do to leverage that very easily, so you can initiate a runbook from wherever you want. And while I'm going back here to discuss best practices, I want to just throw a little pitch out there. Runbook Commander will give you right-click capability in your Configuration Manager console to launch runbooks. I can right-click a collection or right-click a computer, and I can initiate a runbook just as though it's a right-click tool. So if you're not a Config Manager person that knows right-click tools, that may not be interesting. If you know right-click tools, imagine right-click tools on the most effective kind of steroids that you could find in the world, because I can build a runbook, I can accept some input, and drive that automation right out of my Configuration Manager console. So I want to talk to you quick, not about automating, but what should I automate? So there, you're going to have a lot of use cases in your environment, right? We need to figure out which of those are going to be the best candidates for us to automate, because not all processes are going to automate equally. So I need to think about whether Orchestrator is the right tool for the task. Can I deploy software from Orchestrator? Yes. Should I be doing a lot of that? Not without the Configuration Manager integration pack driving that activity through Config Manager. In theory, I could use the run program activity and run MSI command lines and so forth. Not a good way to do this. I'm painting myself into a very dark corner at that point, because I'm building a process that's going to be difficult for other people to troubleshoot and maintain. I need to think about processes being technically feasible for development. Is this a process that involves APIs that I can access, from a computer, machine accessibility. What's the development cost and effort? If I have a process that takes 20 minutes and it happens twice a year and it's going to take me a week to automate it, my ROI, my time to payback, is, equivalent to putting my money under my mattress. Not a good strategy.
So I think what you're saying here is it's the best practice to analyze and to think about what you should automate, but not necessarily everything is really worth that effort.
That's exactly right. So we want to think about the port requirements, because Orchestrator is not agent based. It's going to drive, it's going to initiate a remote process potentially on external machines. It may be, if we're copying files, that could require SMB capabilities, Telnet, FTP, SSH. We've got to think through all of those, and we've got to really be thinking about closing the loop with our CMDB, our ITIL processes from the very beginning here.
And we'll get to that crazy set of acronyms shortly, don't we?
Yes. So death by acronyms delayed anyway. So at the end of the day, we're going to run this wish list of processes you write down for automation, and we're going to find those that occur most frequently that can be automated with a moderate amount or a trivial amount of effort, something to the lower end of the scale. Again, we're not building roaming a day. And we want to make sure the variance is manageable. Can the process be repeated the same way every time? Or if it varies a little bit, do we have a place where we can go find the information we need to close that gap in variance? And you know, that's going to give you your best practices for what we should be dealing with. Now, when we're building the runbooks, okay, there are a few things we can do to make this process easier for the people around us that are going to support this. At the end of the day, I want to build runbooks that are small, they're modular, they're function specific. In my own library, which includes several hundred runbooks, I have a runbook that does nothing but send but email error message. I have another that looks up the distinguished names of security principles in Active Directory.
So can you actually call one runbook from another runbook?
Fantastic question. We expect you're going to do that. There's an activity you can drag onto the palette called Invoke Runbook that allows me to call one runbook from another.
You can essentially chain these as many as you need.
Exactly. My average runbook has less than 10 activities in it. It's typically calling multiple other runbooks and accepting a success-fail answer from that other runbook. So I build many small runbooks. If you find yourself building a runbook and that palette is getting full, you have derailed. Start thinking about breaking those runbooks up into modular, reusable components. And a couple of years down the road, you're going to find that something that might have taken you a week to automate previously, be able to pull together in hours because you have so many reusable components in your library just from you know, recurring effort.
I mean, this is almost going back to this similar concept we've been talking about all day about this private cloud standardization. Now we're thinking about standardizing our runbooks, you know, breaking them up into logical groups, make it highly reusable, and again, reduce that repetitive churn, right, of creating those same set of activities again and again. We're automating our automation process, or improving our automation process, let's say.
Exactly. So it is a fact that the private, you know, private cloud is a journey, right? There's no guarantee that you're traveling in the right direction. So you really need to think through all of these sort of non-technical aspects that we've been covering off today from that very first session. So back to runbook best practices. As I'm building these runbooks, I'm going to rename my activities. Every activity I drag onto the palette can be renamed. So if I'm monitoring a folder and I drag the monitor folder activity out there, I can rename it monitor the Azure folder. If I drag a run SSH command out there, I can say call Red Hat systems. I can recolor these links, so these very plain black links between my components, they can be recolored any color I want. But I'm going to show you some runbooks where we built some intelligence in there, some branching logic to make decisions based on how our process is moving along at runtime, because sometimes our runbook will execute successfully, and other times something is going to fail. And it's when that fail happens that we want to make sure we have error handling built into our runbook, which will typically do in the form of what we call success and failure branches. So, and typically what I'll do is my success branches will have links that are green, and the failure branches will have links that are red, and I will give those links a friendly label so I can label everything in Orchestrator. The idea being here that when Simon comes behind me to look at my runbooks, he can look at a runbook and sort out in a relatively short amount of time what I was doing here, because I've built this runbook in a way that typically flows from left to right, top to bottom. I have color coding that corresponds to success and failure, and I'm logging error messages, whether I'm doing that to a central SQL reference table, which a couple of my Premier Field friends love. Other people like writing to an event log. Other people like to use Create Alert and Operations Manager. It's really all about the situation and what works for your organization. There's not a right way to do that.
So let me just re-ask this question. You mentioned this, but you said that you have things such as pass-fail. You said you can look at putting something on a different infrastructure, Microsoft, VMware, for example. How exactly do these conditional statements work? Is it literally as binary as saying, if I get this result, do this, if I get this result, do this?
Let's just take a look. So there are a million and one examples, but I want to put you on the console here, and we'll just have a look at what that looks like in the real world. So I'm going to go ahead and minimize that component, and we will look at some of the other elements that we've built here. So let's see what I have in some of my existing runbooks in my development environment here. So bear with me in a momento.
Sure. Now, while you go find that, one best practice, though, we're trying to recommend for all of our customers to really try to tie in with this theme of automation is, as you're thinking about future hardware purchases, Make sure there's a programmatic interface so that we can have automation here, whether that's your networking equipment, your storage hardware. Make sure that there's no requirement for someone to have to manually go into a graphical user interface and click around to go and, let's say, carve up another LUN. That breaks our automation. Anytime we need to go and inject that person in there, kills our automation. So again, as you're starting to think about future acquisitions and hardware investments, make sure that we can communicate with the hardware through APIs, functions, any other type of programmatic interface, just so we can build that end-to-end automation throughout the stack.
So I'm going to give you a look at some of my library runbooks. These are very short and very simple, but very, very effective, and I use these every day of my life. So I'm looking at here a runbook that's very clearly named Add User or Group to Local Administrator. So very simple, function specific. Now you notice on the front end of this is an initialized data activity. This is an activity designed to accept input, which is going to make it very service manager friendly. Service manager wants to send input to my runbook. So I'm just going to double click that initialized data activity, and you'll see I've put some values here that make a lot of sense if you're Active Directory conversant. SAM account name, the LDAP search path, the NetBIOS domain name. I've also put the parent runbook in there. Why would I do that, you ask? Well, if I'm nesting runbooks, I always want to know which runbook called this other runbook. So if it fails, I can log an error message to say, here was the error title, here's the error description, and here's the runbook that called me when this happened. So you'll notice that I accept all that input, and then we do a bit of PowerShell work here. So I would say 80% of what I need to do with Orchestrator happens in the UI, the other 20% happens with PowerShell, because I find sometimes I can reuse my existing script that will let me do some bit of work a little more flexibly. Now I'm just going to right-click in this interface. This is a run.NET script activity. You'll notice it's been renamed to Add User or Group to Local Administrator's Group. Very descriptive. And now I don't have to guess what it's doing because I can read really well. And I'm going to just right-click in the interface here, and anywhere where you have a window that doesn't give you enough room, Orchestrator gives you this expand capability. So you'll notice I have a PowerShell snippet here, and I can read. I can drag this interface around a bit. I like to develop my scripts outside of Orchestrator, test them, and make sure they work more or less before I get them in here and start using them, just as a process. You see, I still even though I'm just using little snippets of code, I'm still labeling these. I have some documentation commenting in my code. We call it looking for that word comment was just elusive to me there. But I want you to notice now that we have this, what we call a failure branch. You see it says notify on error. So we saw the default behavior is if the activity initiates successfully, it calls the next activity in the chain. So let's look at this one and see what it's doing. So it is set to if add user or group, if that script returns failed, this link is saying if we fail, you go this way. So this is the failure branch. And you'll notice that it's labeled notify on error. That's because links have labels.
Nice.
Down here in options, I can color code these links. I don't know why. I like my links to be 3 pixels wide. Odd, very odd personal preference, I'll admit. And this one, since this is the success branch, if I just get back to here, the script returns success. I'm going to go here and make this one green because green is good, red is bad. And I want to do that throughout. I'm going to label this. This is best practices kicking in at this point. These scripts, by the way, there is a publish data tab on our run.NET scripts. I can define the name of the variable. So I have a variable in this script called output. A PowerShell variable comes with a dollar sign. I just clip that and I can basically put a friendly label in the variable name. And this is going to be published to that shared data area within this runbook, so I can actually conclusively tell if I've written this little snippet right, you know, if it passed or failed. So check this activity out here. It says send error notification. That is actually a renamed invoke runbook activity. So invoke runbook allows me, there's invoke runbook down here in the activities palette. This allows me to call one runbook from another. I have a runbook that does one thing, it logs error messages. So when I double click this, what I've done is use the little ellipsis here to browse out to my error logging runbook. And it's a very simple runbook that accepts many inputs here. So you see a ridiculous amount of input, but three things I'm going to pass in here. the parent runbook, the runbook that culled this one, the air name and the air description. So I'm building the air handling into my runbook. If notification is appropriate, if logging, you know, an update to an incident or a change request in my service desk is appropriate, I'm going to build that into my runbook. So I'm going to close the loop from a notification perspective, from an ITIL process perspective, all in here. So we need to make sure we do all you know, cover all of those bases as we're planning the process. We don't want to get to the end to, hey, this is great, except how are we going to integrate with our service desk? And hey, we need to send, you know, procurement an email when this happens. We want to cover those off all ahead of time. So again, color your links, rename your activities, build the air handling in there, hard code as little as possible, build them left to right, and boy, test them. You know, when you get these when you get these runbooks to production, it's very easy for us to build these into to get these into production. It's a simple import process. Assume that the person in the chair knows how to import a runbook and they don't care anything about what it does. So it better be tested and bulletproof when we get to production. Treat a runbook as managed code, because that's what it is. It's a fancy XML file at the end of the day. So let's talk about the dynamic duo here, Orchestrator plus Service Manager. So I'd alluded that some people tell me, you know, Service Manager is really optional for a private cloud, and I say, wow, no, you know, we're sort of flying blind. We're naked at that point. So we have all of these common automation use cases, and I don't want to, you know, get into to common use cases, because we all have our special use cases, right? Whether it's self-service, orchestrated patching of some sort, deploying applications, onboarding users, whatever you want to do. Service Manager is going to allow us, through its native connector framework, to trigger runbooks, to drive automation in Orchestrator, to monitor that progress, to log the results of that process in a service request. So at the end of the day, it gives me an intuitive user experience. It gives me access to Service Manager's native approval workflow. It allows me to validate user input, which doesn't happen at all in the web-based interface. And of course, I'm closing the loop with ITSM, right? I'm closing my ITIL loop at that point.
Now, we got a great question that just came in right around validation. Is there any way for us to validate a server's name? So when we go and deploy a brand new virtual machine, we provide it with a name. Is there any way to validate that name to make sure it's not already in use somewhere in the infrastructure?
Yes. So if I'm using the VMM integration pack, the activity is called getVM. So I accept that input from my user in the self-service portal potentially, or I'm auto-naming. Mm-hmm. I can use getVM to go query Virtual Machine Manager and see if there is a VM by that name.
You get a true-false type of return.
What you get is you get a property that comes back called number of objects. And if it returns zero, we know okay. We're good. If it returns anything else, I'm going to bail out. I'm going to log an error message. I'm going to fail it. I'm going to circle back with my folks. Because VMM, you know, typically I like to give it masks in those templates. I can, you know, for SQL, I can do SQL
hash, hash, hash,
and let VMM handle the naming for me. And so it's largely on autopilot at that point. So yeah, I'll just use a getVM and make sure that it returns zero before I go crashing down that path provisioning. Initiating runbooks externally. I'm going to keep this really brief just to keep it on target because I can't stop talking about Orchestrator, frankly. So I mentioned to you there is a PowerShell script out on the MSDN website that will allow us to initiate a runbook from outside Orchestrator. So I want to just cover off what it is we need to do there exactly to make that happen. So predictably, just as we think about runbooks in terms of their friendly names, Orchestrator thinks about runbooks in terms of not friendly names. Orchestrator thinks about PowerShell and the Orchestrator web service think about runbooks in terms of GUIDs. So we have the GUID of the runbook itself, and then if we have a runbook that has those initialized data activity with parameters at the beginning, each input parameter is going to have a GUID as well. So I'm going to look at my samples here, and I actually have a runbook that I created just for the purpose of calling a runbook from the web service. So this runbook, very simple, it has one input parameter, message. Has a second activity here, send event log message. Orchestrator, incidentally, just logs messages to the application event log. So I told this activity, log an info event to localhost, subscribe to the data to get the message that comes in through this runbook. So this script, which you get from MSDN and I copied and pasted, has three lines that you need to modify. Line one, the ID of your runbook. That article gives you a mechanism. It gives you the instructions for retrieving that GUID via the web service in a browser. I'm not a fan of that method, so I'm going to give you a plan B that I think is really simple and really cool. You'll notice the runbook parameter ID here as well. So for each parameter in our runbook, let me see if I can just zoom on this a bit easily. I may not be able to. Suffice it to say, this second line here basically is taking semicolon-separated value pairs, the parameter GUID and the parameter value. And so, for example, I was actually sitting next to my wife when I wrote this, so I have the GUID of the parameter, and the message I was passing was hola mamacita. So I could basically repeat those pairs over and over again right there in the UI. The third piece of information you need to provide right here, orchestrator web service in your environment, /jobs. This is all I need to do. I can now run this from a command line. It's going to return one piece of information if it's initiated successfully. It basically tells me the runbook has started. Now, the friendly way to go get this data from my web service is I can use Excel and the web service. So there's a component called Power Pivot, not installed by default. It's installed by default, but not enabled. You enable it down here on the options menu. So go Bing it and you'll find that. But what the Power Pivot tab gives me is this manage option. So I can now launch this, tell it I want you to go pull data from an external feed. So from other sources, I'll scroll down and there's this other feeds option. So if you actually go just do an internet search on this, you'll find that it's documented on that the process of finding these parameters from these GUIDs from a URL is documented on MSDN. I think I blogged this a while back. So I'll just test the config. This is going to connect into my web service. It's going to show me a bunch of tables that are in my database. I care about two. I want the runbooks table. I want the runbook parameters table. And if I know the name of my runbook, I can easily find the GUID of my runbook, and I can find the GUID of my runbook parameter. So I'll hit finish. I'm going to pick the two tables here, runbook and runbook parameters, and then these are going to be populated in Excel. So what I can do is on the runbooks worksheet, I can find the name of my runbook, and its GUID will be right there. I can take that and go find the parameters easily as well. So I'm on the runbooks tab, and you're going to notice that the runbooks have names, and they have the ID. So the ID of that runbook is the GUID. That's what you care about, those of you that want to initiate these runbooks from somewhere else. So I'm just going to sort these A to Z, because I'm an alphabetical kind of guy. I'm going to scroll down to the C, and in the C's I will find my call from web service runbook. I'll get a little overzealous here, but I want to point out one very big gotcha that's going to be very important to you. Okay, so here's my call from web service runbook. There you see the GUID of this runbook. Now you notice it has curly brackets there, right? When I look at my script, you'll notice I've removed the curly brackets. So here's another sort of secret element to this that you want to be careful of. I don't know how secret it is. It was secret to me. Again, I'm that guy that doesn't always read the instructions, so you want to be careful. So I've gone over to the runbook parameters tab. This is a list of all the parameters that exist in all the runbooks. One of the columns over here is the runbook ID. So I can use the native filtering in here to filter down to runbook ID equals X. And if I've got parameters in there, look at that. There's the one parameter. So now I found both of these were great. All I need to do is make sure when I put them into this script, they need to be, the alpha characters need to be in lowercase. I'm not sure if that's documented out there, but yeah. use PowerShell or Excel to just push them all down to lower. The function is lower in Excel or too lower in PowerShell. Lots of examples of that on the internet. But now I've got a PowerShell script. I can initiate that runbook from anywhere I want, so it doesn't really matter. I want to just cover off cloud capacity provisioning, you know, giving users access to all this stuff. This is the piece we haven't really talked about yet. We provisioned our fabric, we provisioned service templates, we've created runbook automation. We haven't given anybody permission to deploy anything.
Well, that's important, right? We really want to scope it down and make sure that only people have access to certain resources, to certain types of services, to certain types of applications. You know, a lot of that's security, but a lot of that's also to really optimize the data center, right? If we give, you know, an end user access to go deploy a VM anywhere, but they don't really know what they're doing, you know, they could go and start deploying a VM that's based in South America, copy that over the WAN to China, run it in a data center that's not part of your main network. So by scoping it down as well, it not only provides, you know, security, it also helps us enforce best practices within our own data center.
Yeah, exactly. So we want to make the most efficient decision every time. So one less than optimal choice is not going to affect us, but we repeat that times, you know, multiple customers and 100 times, and suddenly it all adds up, and we have sprawl and you know, resource overutilization and so forth. So you know, that's why we're going to be optimizing as we provision access, and then on the back end when we move into the operations phase, metering by use, pushing back some cost, some numbers to people, so we moderate behavior through that that chargeback mechanism. So to Simon's point, we're going to create a cloud, which is the abstraction that defines our pool of network storage compute, the templates we can use for these end users, the VM networks that are accessible, etc. Understanding that the expensive pools are going to be reserved for the critical production workloads. So we'll create clouds for specific needs, you know, whether it's test dev prod, you know, business units, countries, combination thereof. We just want to make sure we have a strategy going in that maps to the fabric as we designed it. We're going to connect our physical infrastructure into the process as well through this create cloud wizard. So we're going to tell VMM what storage classifications, what templates, what network logical networks are accessible, etc. That's all going to be mapped out in this process. It's fairly simple in this wizard to make that happen. We looked earlier at the resource, the five dimensions of cloud capacity, right? So CPUs, memory, disk, the VM count, and of course the quota points. If we want to take the old school route that we saw with VMM 2008. And when I delegate access to private cloud capacity, I want to be very clear that we can delegate at an action level. So I can give people permissions to deploy or maybe just to read. I can give them permission to deploy from template or to build their deployments from scratch, so to use the raw VHDs and profiles and so forth I have in the library. Exceedingly rare that I tend to do that. I'm almost always going to be driving template-driven deployment, so I can define the nice buckets, the classes of service, and I can make this manageable for me, simple for my users. And I'm going to delegate only the tasks I want them to be able to complete. Checkpoints, commonly something we're not going to allow people to do. I might allow that restore from checkpoint option. I might also make an exception in that developer scenario where they have need to manage their own checkpoints, but I'm going to dole that sort of activity out very carefully. Two sort of unique actions you want to be aware of, receive and share, which actually allow users to collaborate in some sense. So we could give people full deployment capability and then allow them to share their resources they create through their libraries together. So if we have a multi-tenant situation, I'd think that would be more of a hoster scenario where we're really just provisioning the capacity and we're hands-free at that point. We're letting the tenant do whatever it is they want to do with their capacity. That sort of collaboration might make a lot of sense there. So when we think of role-based access, we have administrators. We have delegated administrators that are going to be able to manage only subsets of our environment, so maybe only certain, you know, clusters, host groups, pools of storage. We have read-only administrators that we might just want to give read access into the fabric so they can see what's going on in there from a visibility perspective. And then we have the self-service user, our real focus here, which is that application owner who's getting that action level permission within the cloud to deploy up to the quota they have been allocated at this point. here are the actions. This is a little bit cloudy. We'll jump into the UI in a minute, but long story short, I can go through and check the boxes here, allowing users to save, start, stop, shut down, remove, receive, share, deploy from template, you know, take checkpoints or just restore existing checkpoints. I can do all of that in here. And when you're defining those classes of service, I'm gonna break my users into those buckets and have standard sets of actions for those classes of user roles. So my business units might, you know, get a little less than my developers get in IT, for example.
So maybe a good example might be, you know, a developer, they're gonna add code, they wanna test that code, but maybe they don't wanna have to roll back, you know, with a complicated process and recompile. So for example, maybe with our developers, we provide them with access for checkpoints. Take a checkpoint before they do the new build. If it doesn't work, easy to roll back. But our human resources department, they don't need access to checkpoints. We don't want them to even know what that type of stuff is. So best practice, break it down by those rules.
That is exactly right. And as we're abstracting this technology from the end users, even though I'm always using service templates in the background, many times in the self-service portal, I'm using the word VM. I'm not using the word service because I don't want to have to explain the service paradigm to somebody in HR or finance or somewhere else, right? I want to give them a term that they know. Even within IT in certain groups, I'm not going to show them service. I'm just going to say deploy VM or deploy VMs, plural, whatever it takes to make them comfortable in an interface, an experience that's intuitive for them. We won't rehash this, but again, quota capacity, we have the five dimensions. We have the group level quota, we have the user level quota, so we can keep those resource hogs in check by only allowing them to provision a subset of what we have there. So this is going to be a pretty quick look because we've covered a lot of this off already, but I'm just going to jump into my VMM UI and we'll have a look at a self-service user interface. I'm going to learn to use my start menu here so I don't have to minimize all of those windows. And incidentally, if you ever try to open App Controller or the VMM console, let me get out of my PowerPoint there. Again,
So as you switch over here, yeah, having some trouble. The actual configuration of these user roles, that's done through Virtual Machine Manager. So you're going to see that essentially this is where we go and really do a lot of the management. But everything ties into Active Directory. So it's important to consider, you know, you have these different organizational units that you're going to create with AD, but, you know, regardless of which system center component you use, it's still going to speak to AD, look at those user role configurations, and then go and honor those settings based on, you know, your security credentials.
Yeah, so you know, what I was going to say there is PowerPoint 2 Pete 0, but yeah, so great point. And I can assign my users to multiple self-service roles. They may have access to multiple clouds. When you open App Controller, when you open the VMM admin console, heaven forbid we give, you know, a user the VMM admin console, both of those interfaces will prompt you and ask, which role would you like to go into this interface as? Service manager, we're abstracting at a deeper level, so no worries there. So here is where I add my members in that self-service role. So you see I called this Contoso self-service user role. I give it members right out of Active Directory, the interface you're familiar with for many, many years now. Scoping, which clouds can they access? And you can see right here in practice, I've given this role access to both a Hyper-V and a vSphere cloud. Quotas, there they are, group and user. And here, quotas for that second cloud. So you see the interface gave me quotas per cloud automatically. Now I'm getting into those VM networks. I'm controlling where these folks can deploy. So to which tenant environments are we going to have access? So really this cloud is allowing me to take all of the elements that will comprise this tenant environment and put them into a single package, so to speak, that is the cloud. Resources. So you'll notice here I have service templates here because I like to have my users provisioning from templates, not from raw VHDs, etc. I want to minimize their decision criteria and drive them through a simple set of choices. I can limit the templates they can deploy from. As we build new templates, I can come add those to their role after the fact. And my actions. So again, I can control the actions at a very granular level. And I've got that all-important checkpoint or not capability there. And finally, run as accounts. If they need to provide secure credentials in the provisioning of any sort of template or you know, service or VM, we can tell VMM which credentials these folks have permissions to, which means we can grant access to, you know, development and staging, but maybe not production, for example. So I can draw some boundaries here that align to my process and my environment. But that's what it's all about. So, you know, the wizard, very easy to do, a lot more flexible than what we had in the past. In the past, we had that one element of cloud capacity. Now we've got five.
Excellent.
And that is what I know.
Okay. I'm sure you know a lot more than that here. Well, let me pull together everything, quickly summarize where we're at and what we've learned. Now, we've really focused on this concept of the self-service part of the private cloud. So what we've got is we've got our end-user interface. This is where our customers go and make the requests. This is where our customers will essentially say, I need X, I need Y. Behind that, we have our templates, and those are essentially mapping to those end-user requests. They say, I need this VM. They can pick it from a template. They need this type of service. We can map that service request to back-end orchestrator workflow. Now, next thing is this automation piece, whether you're automatically deploying something, say, using Virtual Machine Manager or Orchestrator, that gives that standard and consistent configuration every single time. So essentially, you've really seen kind of these three key pieces that we've gone to give access to our end users, to go and automate the solution, and to ensure that we have standardization when they go deploy it. Now, tell us, what's next? What are we going to learn in our last part of the day?
Yep, so now we need to climb to the top of the mountain. We need to bring all of this together in that CMDB, the self-service interface. The service manager has to get involved at this point. A lot of exciting material to show you, and a few things I'm not going to be able to show you today, but we will cover off on Thursday. So join us after coffee, and we'll close out the day on a high note and set the stage for part two.
Thanks.